Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
I would rather have the Army set up camp in my front yard for 3 months than have a film company turn around in my driveway. So true.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Full disclosure, college dropout, terrible high school student, didn't study film in any formal way.
Yeah,
I'm the opposite.
I worked in DVD stores, watched a million movies.
I did that too.
By director, I read every book I could get my hands on. I skipped every class I ever had in college to spend time in the library reading about how to make films, and on the internet teaching myself how to do green screen and how to work cameras and learning and absorbing everything I could in a completely self-motivated way.
Mm-hmm.
But I did take 2 film classes when I was in college just as electives and just because I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
It's one of these interesting things about learning about film.
Yeah.
You need to give people, for them to like understanding movies, you don't really need to give them all that much. It's like one of these things where if you introduce the concept well enough to understand causal relationships, juxtaposition, and relativity within like a frame, like things being bigger than other things as a way of highlighting importance, or things being closer to the center of the frame to indicate things that are of higher importance. Like these kinds of like basic, really basic principles you build a language of a film around.
Mm-hmm.
Is like once you introduce these basic concepts to people, they learn so much on their own just by continuing to watch different films.
Sure.
So it's a really kind of, to me, is a really interesting and special thing, is you hand somebody a very small key that opens one door, but in doing so, you're giving them many keys to open many doors on their own, because it's something that builds off of itself. Like you can teach yourself film and film appreciation with a very small little push off.
Hey everybody, this is Brad. Welcome back to the show. Today is September 19th. This is part 2 of 3 in our Cinema Manufacturing series with Dutch and Scott. Today's show focuses on the pre-production process. Everything from securing the money to getting a script to scouting locations to figuring out the look and feel of a major motion picture. And we keep teasing you and then delaying a discussion about the actual process of shooting the film. But this was certainly valuable groundwork to lay ahead of time. And part 3 will be entirely devoted to what these guys do on the set during filming. And it's a very interesting conclusion to our discussion. And even though Scott went back to New York to work on his next project, Dutch is still here. And you should know this, Dutch fans, that we are going to be doing more content together, more film exploration coming in the very near future. I think we talk about it just a little bit at some point in this series. It has been so great having Dutch here. We've done a lot of exploring of the city together. We've gone to Deutschtown to eat sausages, and we've gone to Southside to eat chicken wings. You know, we went to the Pirates game at PNC Park, one of the greatest Major League Baseball stadiums that there is. Dutch took us to the game. Remember when I was being all jack-offy about that whole experience in the Won't You Be My Neighbor show with Andrew and Zach? We stand on the bridges around the city, at least 2 of them we've stood on. We go up to Fine View and look at the view. It's really been an amazing experience, and I'm certainly going to miss Dutch when he is no longer here. So lots about to happen. That's all I'm going to say today. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And thank you, everybody who answers the call You know, when I ask for help keeping the show going through Patreon or through the AV Club, you can see all of our support options at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. I'm going to be posting a video soon on Patreon of this new studio that I've been making. You might have heard recently I reported in that we were 87% done. It's fallen down to about 72% because I have some new ideas. And that's going to mean taking some things apart and putting new, better things together in here over the course of the next month. And I'm trying to make decisions about things I need and waiting for packages to come filled with things that I've already decided that I'm getting. Very exciting process. I'm feeling quite at home here. So thank you so much for your help, whether it was in the past, you know, or it's something you're presently doing. That's ideal, really, present help. Or it's something you're planning on doing in the future. Thank you so much. All right, Cinema Manufacturing continues now. Here we go.
I never learned, no matter how much I did self-guided teaching, which is everything I learned about making movies was done this way.
Mm-hmm.
Totally self-guided. Watched a million movies, watched behind the scenes, got every book I could get my hands on. The thing I never learned, and I took some film classes at college, even though I was a history major, I just like took like kind of electives, so film classes.
Yeah.
The thing I never, ever, ever learned is what the fuck the process is. So I would love to, who knows, maybe it's like two people in your audience or people that are like, oh, I want to be a filmmaker.
It doesn't matter. I've surveyed, what do you want more of? What do you want to return? The movie topics, like we did a series called School Sucks at the Movies.
Yeah.
Me and a couple of my friends had this series called Conspirathon, where there'd be these marathons.
You showed me the artwork from it. It's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I want to make posters of those for in here. But then we did a Conspirathon Silver Screen Edition,
right?
Which was tremendous amounts of speculation, but people found it very entertaining. So people love the movie topic.
Yeah.
And because of the level of expertise in this room right now,
mm-hmm.
even if it was just a sort of passing interest for most people, like getting into it in this level of detail, I guarantee it, because this is translatable to certainly other things, right? We're trying to find some principles here. So, yeah, I would love to be able to focus on the day-to-day process, right?
Yeah.
The process of making the film.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we're going to talk about is how education...
We can do more of that in the future, too, if you want.
What's that?
And we can do more of that in the future if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love that.
Yeah. Where we just talk about like, this is how you conceptualize something.
All right.
That's what a movie is, right? It's like you're taking an abstract conception and making it into a physical reality.
Indeed.
It's like, what's the process there? And there's a lot of different processes at play, but also a lot of different ways to like cut that up.
Yeah.
And we can even like look at movies and be like, this is how that process came. And this is like how the philosophy like stems out of like... The philosophy of the film informs the process of materializing it in a lot of instances.
Indeed. The other part is education, right?
Yeah.
In which just touched on briefly and a little bit in the first part. But education or lack thereof, as far as what most people think of education as being. Are you educated to do this?
No.
You know? Well, yeah.
Most people would say to me is absolutely not.
Now, you started as, what were you doing? A janitor?
Are we starting?
We're starting.
Have we started?
Yeah.
Oh, this is delightful. Okay. So I started, I wasn't a janitor. My first job was on Law & Order Special Victims Unit,
mm-hmm.
the television program. I came into it around the ninth season. And I had such an entry-level job that, like, it's just, like, not even on the radar. Like, I was the construction shop production assistant.
All right.
My duties included... there was a shop, right? Just to kind of what that means, construction shop. There is a shop a mile away from the stage in North Bergen, New Jersey. They no longer shoot North Bergen, New Jersey. They've moved their stages and all that stuff. But when they used to do the show, when I worked on it, it was North Bergen, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. The stage was in a swamp. And then up at the top of the hill, there was this little warehouse where they would build the sets.
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen in this warehouse is these carpenters, what are called construction grips, who are people that physically will like put the set together and make sure it doesn't fall on everyone's head.
Mm-hmm.
And then scenic artists, which are painters, would basically, if your studio here, which is, a room with two doors and a window, if they were going to build it, they would do so like modularly, right? So they'd build all these like little flats that are your walls and these doors that are only, you know, maybe 8 foot tall by 6 foot wide or mm-hmm. 5 foot wide. And they would do it in sections, but they'd build it in sections, paint it, and transport it over to the stage where the construction grips would then put it together.
Okay.
And then that's how they'd build each set. So they would do all of like the construction of taking plywood and 2x4s and then making walls and this awesome table that has a hinge in the middle.
Right.
They would build this remotely, transport it all, and then assemble it on site.
That is compartmentalization.
Oh my God, isn't it ever, right?
Yeah.
That's not even the shooting. Yeah, this is just building physical construction of a set, right? So it has its own location, which has its own resources. I was a resource at that remote location where my job essentially was to make sure there was food there for these carpenters and construction guys, right? Because they had to have a union-mandated craft service area. So I would go to the grocery store every Monday. I'd ask the guys what they wanted, and I'd go buy them, you know, Hot Pockets and, pretzels and whatever the heck that they wanted to eat.
Hot Pockets?
Yeah, have lying around, and I'd make coffee, and I'd go pick up bagels, really, you know, good bagels. Donuts. And there'd be bagels and donuts and coffee and snacks every day. Huge part of my job.
Yeah.
probably the almost the biggest part of that job. And then the other part of it was I'd keep the offices clean, keep the bathrooms clean, and I would keep everything clean but the workstations and the shop floor itself, because that was a union position. So I was like allowed to clean the toilets, and my responsibility was cleaning toilets. But I wasn't allowed to push a broom on the shop floor.
How long ago was this?
Oh, this was in 2005 and 2006.
Okay.
That's when I got into the business. So, wow, 13 years, I guess I've been doing it. Yeah, 13 years. That was my first job.
How about you, Scott?
My first job?
Mm-hmm.
I was at Wright State, which is a college in Dayton, Ohio. It's actually a good school. Film school was a good experience, but it was during the summer, and there was a movie shooting close to where the school was, and a lot of graduates of the program were like department heads on it. Mm-hmm. And I had known them because they came to the school to kind of give like, you know, lectures or like, this is what a C-stand is and this is how you set a flag, that kind of stuff. And so they helped me get on that movie. And I was the office PA for a couple weeks, and then I was the second AC when we were shooting.
Assistant camera.
Yes. Yeah, second assistant camera.
So is that, what are you, pulling focus, or is that separate?
No, that's the first AC.
You're helping the person who's pulling the focus.
Yeah.
You're giving them numbers and stuff?
Giving them numbers,
taking
giving them
notes.
Gear, keeping the gear organized, mm-hmm. keeping notes on the gear.
I bet a lot of people don't even know this. These cameras, now this might be changing a little bit with some, well, not with some of these smaller digital, like the Reds that people are using to shoot movies. You still have a focus puller?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's one of the hardest jobs on a movie set.
Absolutely. So you,
first AC.
You have two people, pretty much, primarily two people running a camera.
Three.
Okay, three.
Because you have a, as far as it pertains just physically to the camera, you have a camera operator.
Who is looking through the lens.
Correct. Who is sometimes a director of photography.
Okay.
Who's looking through the lens and either, you know, there's two versions of that now too. There's like the newer method is kind of a tilt and pan camera on a like swiveling head.
Okay.
And then the old school, which you've probably seen in like pictures and stuff, are like a camera with two wheels.
Yes.
That makes it pan and tilt and slide and do all of the movements that the camera does. So there's that person. And then there's someone who pulls focus. That's a first assistant camera. So they are actually either hand on a knob on the camera, or the newer way is that there's like a remote, what's called a follow focus.
Right.
So what it is you have like a big lens that has a ring that is setting essentially a focal length of distance for what you want to be in focus. And yeah, there's a person who is standing off with a smaller wheel on like a mobile device, basically.
Right.
That controls what's on the camera at the same time. And they are twisting this knob. And when they twist it in one direction, the focus comes closer to the lens. And when they twist it in the other direction, the focus goes longer to the lens.
So they are like out there ahead of time measuring distances and stuff like that.
And then there's a second AC, which will assist that person. So if they need to get measurements or marks of certain distances, because you're either going to watch a monitor or pre-monitor days, a focus puller, which the operation's basically the same, right? Is you look at the lens, you look at the camera and the lens, and then you look at the object.
Mm.
So let's just say it's a shot of a person walking down a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
You would measure the distances at the points in which you want to hit a specific point of focus, and you might put like a little chalk mark on the ground so that this guy is off the side of the scene, a guy or gal is off to the side of the scene and watching as the actor's feet are hitting those chalk marks so that they're turning that knob where it's landing exactly on these
on a distance knobs. Number. Yep. Yeah. All right.
So a second AC will help you do that as well. They'll help you get those marks. They'll help you kind of maybe even there's times with a second AC that's such a long and such a precise shot that they are on a walkie-talkie calling those numbers out as the actor hits them because the focus puller is so far that they can't even see the marks.
Goddamn.
So it's like a really – and then you usually have a film loader or a DIT who is handling either the film that you've shot and changing the mags
mm-hmm.
in a bag, in a little black bag that they put their hands into so it doesn't get exposed by light.
Right.
But then they'll also help track and manage the equipment and do inventory and make sure that there's enough cans of compressed air ordered and enough tape that you have to make marks for actors.
And how was the progression? I have both of you answer this, I guess, quickly so we can get into that, towards working where you were now or what were the highlights?
That's kind of interesting because we took two different paths.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
For me, on that movie, I met a script supervisor because second ACs and script supervisors work a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They work closely together. She helped me get a commercial in Columbus because that movie was like in Dayton.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, she also helped me get a commercial in Cincinnati. And I worked mostly in commercials in Ohio, mostly Cincinnati, sometimes small movies. And after like 3 or 4 years of working on like toothpaste commercials and things like that, you know, I was ADing them as well, not only as a PA. I was like an AD for like smaller commercials. Then I moved to New York and kind of started over. Didn't really know anybody and just knew I wanted to work on movies.
Yeah.
And so I was a PA for about 3 years or something like that. And then you get a certain amount of days to join the Directors Guild of America, the DGA. And you do what's called turning your book in. And then it gets accepted. And then I started working as an assistant director. And so the difference there between he and I is that I took the more traditional route, which is you work your days as a PA, turn in your book. You start usually as an additional second AD, which is you usually come in kind of day play for like big jobs, like big background days, things like that.
So if you have like a scene,
there's like 1,000 extras.
You're going to shoot 1,000 extras. You bring on some more assistant directors who will help wrangle those people, or you got a big stunt day, you'll want better qualified than PAs that work for you in your department that will be able to handle that stuff.
Right. Okay.
And I did a lot of that. And I also was a second, on a movie set. You know, you have a first AD, a second AD, and then it's called, at least in America, it's a second. I think in Europe, it's they call it a third.
In Japan, they call it a first, second, and third, yeah.
Okay. And then it was a second, which, again, this is the traditional route. And then you go, traditionally, you go from second to seconding. And that's where I am now. I've been seconding for a while.
Right.
I've done some firsting, but yeah. Mostly second and seconding the past like 7-8 years.
Gotcha. And I went a weirder way. So right. I went from buying groceries for salty
carpenters
who lived in New Jersey to I just begged the folks there on the show that I really, really wanted to work on set. So what I would do is after the workday ended at SVU is I at the shop, because the shop worked normal hours and the shooting crew worked different hours.
Yeah.
So I would just go to watch the shooting crew film and they would let me just watch. So I just sat there and I put a walkie talkie on because everybody on the movie, you know, movie sets walk, like everybody communicates via walkie talkie. And I'd sit on the walkie talkie and I'd listen to the camera people talk all day. And then I'd listen to the grips talk all day. And I'd listen to the electricians talk all day. And I'd listen to the Teamsters talk all day. And I was like, oh, it was great. I'm just going to learn how to make movies like this.
Wow.
And then I begged them for a job on set. So I started as a PA on set with them. And I did that for, I don't know, 4 months. And then a thing happens usually in places where there's film production, steady enough film production in any city, right? Whether it's Los Angeles or New York or even a place like Pittsburgh or Philadelphia that has at least, you know, can handle two or three movies at a time.
Yeah.
You get a lot of people that, you know, just kind of everybody knows everybody. And so you just kind of wind up working on a lot of different stuff. And if you're any good at your job, your name gets around pretty quickly and you'll get more work. And so I did that in the PA level. I saw there to be, I wasn't sure. So all these PAs were like, yeah, I want to work as a PA, put my days in, work as a second, work as a second, and then get work as a first. And then do that to leap to being a director or producer or something. Right.
Right.
And, my personal view on it was like, wow, I don't want to invest all of this time building towards a goal of being a first AD and then get there and be like, this job is awful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's like it's a big investment of time to put in to get to being that thing. So I was like, I should try it first. So I tried it on like non-union, really, 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 really small films. And I was like, oh. And not only can I do this, this is highly enjoyable, but because I had done it once and then done it twice and done it 3 times, people just kept on calling me to do that.
Right.
And then it became, oh, well, I'm making enough money doing these small movies that it's actually the same for me as working as a PA on these big movies. Plus, I get the added bonus that I'll get the more experience as a first AD.
Right, right.
So then that's what I did. And what's really funny about us is Scott has gone one way kind of up the chain and I've gone another way up the chain. And just timing wise in our careers is like, we've met each other while you were basically starting. We met up again because we had PA together. Then I went out and basically started traveling for all the time for work. And I was traveling all over the country. And there was a point where I didn't see you for like a really long time,
like 4 or 5 years.
I didn't see anybody in New York after being working in New York for years and years and years. And basically, when I came back for the first time, now myself as like a union member doing like a show for, you know, like a cable, like an HBO show.
Yeah.
And I needed to hire somebody. I was like, oh, Scott is the second AD now. And he's been doing it. And that's somebody I loved working with when I used to work here as a PA. And it just like everything had just kind of funnily, in a funny way, timed out. So that you were exactly where you were at, and I was exactly where I was at, kind of meeting in the middle. And it's been great for both of us. We like working together.
Yeah.
Even though I hate him personally, I would just want to say that on the record. I want that on the record. I don't hate him.
Was there a time when you
hated him?
Or didn't like him? Or didn't think you guys were?
No. I just like to tease him a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you guys have a very special relationship, and sure. I like to see it. And it's a nice thing that it hasn't come through. Like, there's things that I can see from the three of us hanging out that haven't come through in the audio of this show, but it's nice to see this. I think this is a very cool story. Yeah. And, you know, you were just in New Orleans working on a project together. Is it hard to like plan for the future of like, yes, we should work together on this?
All the time.
Cause yeah. So a first AD is on a job longer than a second AD. Mm-hmm. So I have to usually do a job in between jobs with Dutch.
Right.
So, just timing wise.
Yeah.
Because I try and do no more than two movies a year.
I usually do like three.
Yeah. Right.
So I will try and take time off in between those projects. So on top of the fact that there's usually a gap in that I will be on a film maybe in pre-production for twice as long, if not more, than you'll be on that same project, I also might add 2 months off in that time. And then, yeah, so that'll be you having to work because it fits. And then if my job goes away for... This is the scary part about always working in the film business for everybody is like things happen very quickly in both directions. So there'll be times where it's like, hey man, I got a movie we're going to do. And you'll be like, cool, I'm going to take this other movie in between. I'll be like, great. And then after that, clear your schedule out, buddy. And then, you know, like 3 weeks before I'm supposed to leave, it's like, hey Scott, I just got off the phone with the producers and this film that we were supposed to do is not happening anymore. So, you know, you should go and find another job now.
Yeah.
So you know, there's a lot of kind of having to protect yourself to keep working with the people that you want to work with, but also to protect yourself to not, you know, go broke waiting for your friends' jobs to go on, which is, I think, for both of us are people that like to work with our friends, and I try to exclusively do that. Like, when I work with directors, I'm always trying to work with people that I'm very, very close with, that I have a close relationship with, that are people I enjoy working with. And so part of that is like when your buddies say, yeah, we're going to do this movie out in this part of the country or whatever in a couple of months, I got to kind of take a leap of faith every time because sometimes things don't always pan out.
Gotcha.
The production that we met on in New Orleans was supposed to happen 1 year earlier.
Yeah.
So this is fun. This is going to be a fun exercise. It was supposed to happen 1 year earlier and in Savannah, Georgia.
Okay.
The movie got pushed, and basically for all intents and purposes canceled in a way that we didn't know if it would ever happen again.
Right.
And then it just so happened to come together at the right time, move from Savannah, Georgia, to be based as a production now in New Orleans. And it was literally one person's decision whether or not to do the movie at that specific time of year. It was like one person's whim. Hell, it was the difference between us meeting and having this podcast here and us never meeting at all.
Wow.
And yeah, that happens all the time. So yeah, it does get tricky.
So let's zoom in on the actual production.
Let's do it. I'm excited about this.
Where do we begin? You want to talk about a day, or you want to talk about... I'd like to talk about the entire process.
Let's do the entire process, shall we?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll give you my best perspective of the entire process.
And please, Scott, just pepper in whatever you like along the way here. That'd be helpful.
Yeah. A script is written. A star is born. No.
So this is where I worked, right? I worked in an office for my uncle's production company. I took a semester off from college to do this. He had a partner that had an office in Woburn, Massachusetts.
Right.
It was in an office park. I went in. It was a windowless room. It had a rotary telephone on a metal desk. And the entire room was filled with screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
And my job would be to sift through them. And he said, I got to get all these out of here. So they would go to a dumpster, you know. So I'd sift through them. He said, if you find anything interesting, call New York and have it sent there.
Right.
Otherwise, take it to the dumpster. And he gave me, there was like a rubric for how to do this.
Right.
Right. So that's what I did. And the end of every day ended of my internship with a couple of boxes, a trip to the dumpster.
Yeah.
With people's dreams.
People's dreams. Yeah. Everybody's got a script.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say you have a great one.
Okay.
Right? You have a great script and you want to get that script made, right? I think we should, if we want to, This is more the businessy side, which we'll maybe it's worth kind of glossing over to get to like the creative materialization of how a movie is made. You have a script and a director, and basically what you're trying to do with the script is put a package together. So either that package is partly the producer, so some sort of name recognition in that, a script written by a writer that is either a recognizable or accomplished name, and then a director who's an experienced or accomplished director, and then maybe an actor or two, right? And let's just say these are your movie stars, and this is like your package, right? You're trying to sell that package and raise money to be able to make the movie. Mostly these days, it feels like mostly outside of the studio system, but even in the studio system, is you want to figure out how much you're going to pre-sell the film for in foreign territories. So how much is this asset worth, these actors, this director, this kind of script, this genre, in foreign box office sales in the UK, Italy, Germany, Japan, China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is the base number. Let's just say this film is worth $10 million overseas. Then there are, you know, companies who will quantify that, raise money and equity and put together essentially the money to make a film.
Right.
Based on its perceived value. One of the biggest parts of this, I think, as far, especially for anyone who ever wonders about the question is like, you're watching a movie on TV and it's just awful, or you're in the movie theater and you're like, who makes these things?
Sure.
Like, who would ever green light such a thing?
Right.
Like, it's usually lots and lots of people, and not only through the process of like committee, but in the process of like testing the strength of the sales of offers to make the film to active bidders, right? It's like they all kind of, in a way, everybody that's bidding on a package, which is, let's just say, a Martin Scorsese film starring Leonardo DiCaprio about Howard Hughes.
Okay. I love it.
That's, right?
This sounds
like a
winner.
By the way, spoiler alert, it is a winner, and that movie is amazing. But yeah, that's kind of the thing, right? Is like everyone's bidding on how much they're willing to pay for that movie is like dictating its price and its value and its budget. So there's like a lot of people directly and indirectly who are responsible for those bad films that you see, because, you know, it's very, very rare, like Tommy Wiseau rare, that someone's just going to like take their own money and like make their own movie.
Right.
Like from scratch. It just doesn't really, it's usually such a big investment and risk and like any of those kinds of ventures that involve, you know, lots of capital and risk, is it's usually somebody else's money.
Well, one of the things we've talked about on the show before is that, like, when you saw the demise of the studio system through the 60s and the 70s, when obviously there became not just a different style or maybe like a different philosophy entering into the filmmaking business through the New York guys, or like, you know, people who wanted to violate the production code, stuff like that. Yeah. So you see this more guerrilla filmmaking style. There's cheaper ways, grittier ways to make movies. And that obviously produces so much of what we see in the 70s.
The technological advances to allow.
There's that, right? Because before that, you have to have the concentration of all of the money and resources in these big studios, because there was no other way to do this. I mean, I guess you have a beginning where it's like, yeah, you know, nobody really knows what to do. So if you can get your hand on the thing that, you know, runs the film through the camera, you can make some kind of a film. Mm-hmm. But then once the productions reach the scale that they reach in like the 50s and the 60s, only a handful of studios have the power to be able to do that. And now, you know, 50, 60 years away from that, where, you know, almost any of us, there's consumer grade 4K cameras.
Well, I'd actually even argue this, right? Like this, the time that you're talking about, like the 60s, 70s, like Easy Riders, Raging Bull, like this kind of like early Scorsese, all these like really, really, really like creative filmmakers that were doing like wild and unprecedented things, right? Like broke the industry, opened the end of the Hays Code, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's what you're going for, right? Like a huge technological advance is in the cameras in and of themselves too.
Right, sure.
Them being actually being smaller and being able to do sync sound, but also like one of the biggest like technological things that I, in my opinion at least, led to filmmakers being able to work outside of the studio, right? For like Sweet Sweet Beck's Badass Song to be a movie that could like even exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's like begged and borrowed and steeled to make is like the biggest thing is like more sensitive film is like a really, really, really big deal. Is like when you look at the really old studio epics, mm-hmm. right? Every single part of those frames is lit because they're using these massive, giant, giant lights to light scenes because they need to expose the film.
Right.
So if you wanted to build something on a stage, like, you know, two different things, right? We're shooting a horse outside running to examine how its like legs move.
Right.
Part of film in the sun, full sunlight, right? Versus you wanted to build a set for Ben-Hur that's going to have to be in a dark warehouse in like Burbank or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Is to get that same kind of exposure with film that wasn't as sensitive required, like, you watch like something like The Wizard of Oz, right?
Yeah.
Everybody is sweating all the time in that film. Like you watch it like you're
yeah,
like,
yeah, absolutely.
Because it's like a jillion degrees with these like massive, massive lights. But then like you get like these cameras that are like, you know, then this like film that has the sensitivity that you can shoot.
The Godfather Part Two.
Yeah. Or you can shoot more like you can shoot almost basically at night. Without yeah. having to light things, or you can shoot with natural and practical lighting.
Less it's, restrictions.
That just means that now you don't need this entire arm of the apparatus, which is a huge part of like the financial restraints of making a film, which is like these big, massive lights. And
even the real estate,
environments.
For that, you know, to have yeah. a massive, massive sound stages for these, you know, period productions, the yeah. things that you can't shoot outside because you, for whatever reason, you can't yeah. build parts of
now
the set
the camera's
outside.
Small, now the camera in the 60s, 70s is small enough and quiet enough and sensitive enough where you can shoot in your mom's apartment in Queens
yeah.
or in the Upper West Side. Or you can shoot in a nightclub in New York City. You know what I mean? Like there's like this thing of like why there all of a sudden is this like New York boom of filmmaking.
In the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because you could shoot it.
Yeah.
Right? Like you can shoot the interiors in a way. And it's like the kind of thing that went like hand in hand with the practical location kind of vibe of those New York filmmakers that was so, so, so much different than the LA studio picture. For that very reason is like, it was like almost like in a certain sense, like an untapped thing,
mm.
right? Where that you could go now into these beautiful and unique and small New York, intimate New York City settings, like an apartment in the Upper West Side. When, you know, 30 years ago, you wouldn't be able to fit the camera through the door.
It's so interesting too, the translation. Like I think of somebody like Scorsese, who I love, oh, obviously.
Me too.
And he grew up going to the movies and watching these kinds of productions that were so grand in scale,
mm-hmm.
entirely in these bright lights, entirely on these sound stages, yeah. falling in love with that, and then making those New York movies like Taxi Driver and Mean Streets that you're talking about.
Yeah,
right?
And it almost
it's
comes
interesting.
Out of the necessity too, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, yeah it's a really... Oh man, it informs so much, and it's like such a weird thing to look at in retrospect. But it like, because you know, it's like everyone's like, "Well, this is a genius," and this is, but it's like there are so many decisions in that time period that are like spawned and bred from purely an economic position.
Exactly, because when he had the resources, he made the movies that were grand in scale, like Last Temptation mm-hmm. of Christ, Age of Innocence.
Yeah,
I'm forgetting
New York, New York.
Yeah, you sure? Yeah. yeah.
Not
but
a fan
that
of musicals,
I mean
but.
Hugo, you yeah. know, like things that so it's interesting when you talk about necessity because it shows if you think about how he fell in love with movies, right? Just what I know about his biography,
mm-hmm.
and then like what the movies looked like, how different the movies he started making looked
yeah.
from those movies that he fell in love with. But then eventually he got to the scale I think he wanted.
Yeah,
I mean, and he always had ways to expand the scale. Just in like, you know, the storytelling style and the characters and the page. Like there were always right. ways to make it as interesting as one of these huge movies would be, I guess. Honest. Go ahead. Yeah.
The thing that's weird about this, though, the thing that's different that you saw was people that were coming outside of the tradition of the studio, and like the only reason that these people kind of sprang up and existed, these like scrappier kind of filmmakers that we're talking about, is because there was a door that was open, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was financially made it viable. Not only financially, but the technology also made it viable that these people could make small films. So like there's nobody ever kind of discusses in the world of Scorsese like Boxcar Bertha, right? It was like the really, really, really small film that he was able to make that was, you know, financed with far, far less money than anything else, right?
Uh-huh.
Or you fast forward ahead a little bit to like all of the filmmakers of the 90s who even had like even a little bit more of that edge, like a Quentin Tarantino or Darren Aronofsky and all these guys is like, they didn't shoot their movies digitally. It was the same format. It was the same kind of expenses, right? But it mm-hmm. was just like the sensitivity of the film, the speed of the lenses, right? Allowed the company, the actual film company with the lighting and different things to become smaller and smaller and smaller. So like your camera is smaller and smaller and smaller too, right? Means you can steal more shots.
Yep.
Means you can go and shoot in locations you couldn't shoot in before without permission because your camera and your footprint was so darn big. Where now you can like, you know, your camera's sensitive enough to light that, hey, we can go steal shots on the New York City subway system.
Right.
Right? We're still talking about shooting film. It's not like digital in any way, like has this like great boom or revolution where...
Well, this was my question. I mean, this is actually how we got down this whole road because you were talking about financing film.
Yeah.
Right? And then I'm thinking like, well, have you seen the documentary that Keanu Reeves hosts where he interviews all the filmmakers?
I haven't seen it, but I heard it's
excellent.
It's phenomenal. I forget what it's called, but it's...
Side by side.
Yeah. Right? Where, you know, he's talking to all... To like James Cameron, Scorsese, Spielberg, I think Spielberg, but Lucas is definitely in it.
David Lynch
is a big part of it. And they're talking about the transformation from film to digital and why some of them have opted for digital. And I think they even go into – and this has got to be 10 years old at this point, this film. The things like the Red camera. And now like the barrier to entry, I would think, would be so much lower. It would have some impact on the process of setting up a production.
Sure.
Right? That people would even be willing to – take more chances once you can get a budget down to a certain point, people would be willing to take more chances. And this could actually be a kind of revolution in the industry itself.
Yeah. I think the revolution actually already happened. I think things like I'm saying, like, I think things like 16 millimeter film and things like this and these small cameras that were basically like you're talking about the difference of a point of no one but the studios being able to make a film.
Mm-hmm.
To anybody with over $100,000 to a couple of million dollars can make a film.
Yeah.
Which, like, that is, like, the big split and chasm. And, like, everything that's happened in the digital kind of thing in that world is in the aftermath of that original kind of big revolution. So it's like people now, you can shoot a movie on your iPhone, and people are trying to shoot movies on their iPhone, but it's kind of like an exercise of, like, because you can do it. But it's like... if you can afford what you want to put in front of the lens, the costumes, the actors, and those things,
right?
Then the camera is kind of the least of your worries at this point. I think like the next kind of precipice is like, can you do all of your own effects? Like when you can do your own Lord of the Rings style effects pretty accessibly, to a high quality or full CG from home in a really meaningful way, you might see even more of a transition, right?
Yeah.
Where you'd see just, I think all we're talking about is a greater percentage of people that have the microphone versus that don't before them in a certain way. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
That is just the ability went from these handful of studios that control everything to anybody that's willing to get into the game in some way can sort of, for a very small amount of money, relatively speaking, is you can get into the game. You know, like at this point, how many success stories of under $1 million movies exist from the 70s on is like, I mean, there's a ton.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
So what, let's get back to the tracks of the
making
process.
Making a movie.
Making a movie, right? Yeah. And we were at that. We went off there to talk about many things.
Many
and that was
things.
All great. But
so
setting
we have
up
a script,
the production. Right?
Right. The script is good. We've raised money. We've mm-hmm. either gone to the studio with this thing, or we're scrappy filmmakers who are independent in this time that we're talking about. That's post 60s and 70s. And we've raised $5 million to make a movie.
Right.
Let's start from this point forward, right? So the first thing that you, I think, would do is determine the area and location in which you are going to make your film.
Where?
Right. Where?
Right.
What the considerations that go into where are not just the movie takes place here, so here is where we should do it, right? There's a whole litany of costs that go along with it as far, and also accessibility, right? So if you, for instance, didn't have a lot of money, you might be drawn to, let's just say your movie took place in,
Maryland. Place that's inaccessible? Or?
A place that's, that doesn't, I was trying to use like a tax rebate as a sort of model here, because that's so prevalent today. You're in a place like Utah that doesn't have a film incentive. Let's just say, I think they actually might.
They do know.
Yeah, let's just say they didn't. For
they don't know.
Oklahoma.
Okay.
There you go. Oklahoma. Let's just say the movie's supposed to take place in Oklahoma. That's where the script's been written for.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something specific to Oklahoma and its aesthetic that is critical for telling
story.
The story and giving the narrative. It's the whole reason for why it's something is set there, right? The first thing that you'd probably do is start figuring out which state offered a tax incentive, right? That mm-hmm. was close enough to, or the state that you want to shoot it in yourself, the location, and begin the cost analysis of where does the equipment come from? Because I need a camera
mm-hmm. right?
and the type of cameras that I want to use. Like a professional movie camera, I want it to be a professional quality. That has to come from somewhere else because it doesn't come from Oklahoma. Where are the actors going to come from? Are there actors in Oklahoma? What is the local theater program like? What is, you go through kind of the litany, right, of where am I able, primarily, where am I able to source the things that I need to make the film?
That looks like Oklahoma.
Right.
So if I was if I wrote a Western that took place in Oklahoma, not only would I want that landscape to be what it's supposed to be, I would like there to be, like, let's just say, an old Western town that looks correct there. But if that didn't exist, then I would want to make sure that I had the resources that I was able to build such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, I would want people who were experienced in building those sorts of things, particularly for films. Because they know exactly how durable they need to be versus not durable. Like you wouldn't hire, you'd rather have a movie carpenter team, construction team that understands, okay, we only have to build things around the lens, what the camera's seeing, and we can cheat this, 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 and this by using these super cheap materials because
yeah.
we're going to build a balcony that no one ever needs to walk on.
Do teams build reputations based on genres like this?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes,
I figured that would be the way.
Yeah. Where do I source those clothes? Do those clothes that everyone's wearing going to come here from this town in Oklahoma, right? So
yeah.
you go through this whole thing, which is what we call like very soft prep.
Yeah.
So you are seeing where you're going to film. Once you're seeing where you're going to film, you're kind of scouting locations that are both broad and specific, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say in our make-believe Western here, one of the hero sets is a ranch
okay.
where the hero comes from and his family's from, whatever. You might go and see in four different states, all with varying tax incentives, varying different costs of getting materials and people to and from, and then look at the best ranches that you found from each and kind of weigh the pros and cons.
Yeah, because there's got to be this other calculus here with proximity, right? Like, yep. say you're cutting frequently in the film between two locations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, one is in Oklahoma, where it needs to be in Oklahoma, and that's great, but the perfect ranch is in North Carolina.
Yep.
Right? That seems like it would be at least a headache in most. Now you have to schedule it, but I would even think, like, wait a minute, they shot all of these scenes in January of 2012, and then they shot all of these scenes that are intercut between those scenes, months later or somewhere else. I mean, most productions obviously don't work on that time scale. I know, but
you want to know a wild one of those that involves Pittsburgh?
Please.
So in The Dark Knight Rises, the fight between Bane and Batman near the end.
At Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they shot One Direction in the summer in Pittsburgh. And then they shot, One Direction, they shot, I forget whose coverage it was. I think it might have been Bane's. But so they're looking one way and they see Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And they shot that. And I think it was in the summer. They shot the turnaround of that, the other side
of it.
In New York.
That's right. Because it's like, the street scene.
Yeah, at the end.
Where everyone runs together.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Do you know why, what the rationale for doing that was?
I think Nolan just liked the way one side looked in Pittsburgh and one side looked in New York.
Yeah.
That's a pretty drastic example, though.
Yeah.
That kind of, he and Kubrick, it's almost not fair to talk about them in relation to the rest of the business because they have so much control.
But it's still the same concept, right? Which is part of the factoring in of your soft prep, right? Would be doing things like storyboards.
Scouting.
And just the visual conceptualization of what the movie needs to be and starting to map, right? It's almost like I should have started with this. You want to start to map this script of words into a visual representation.
How do you avoid a kind of paralysis in these choices? Because you got to think that, especially when you're looking at like really specific things like restaurant interior, you have even just in one city, right? So you just went through this process to some degree.
Sure.
Okay, looking for locations a film.
Yeah, did we ever.
How do you go from this incredible plethora of choices down to making a decision?
So it is the mapping out of it, right?
The physical mapping out or the mapping out of the production?
It's like the mapping out of the idea.
Okay.
Right? So it's like, because of the nature of this scene, because what is trying to be communicated, right, or the tone that is trying to be set. A director would start from, I think, the concept of to reflect what it is I am trying to reflect in, like, the grammar of the movie, right, is this location should feel like X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So this restaurant, right, because restaurant is a broad thing. Table. It's like, what kind of table? Dining room table, living room table, coffee table, right? Restaurant is so broad, so you would give it all of its specificity if it's not already written in the script. You may, for instance, a director may storyboard this thing and draw it and show this to people and say the restaurant should look like this. It's this size. It has this kind of decor. It has that, right? Another thing would be pulling images from stills, photographers, other movies, other things, and it says, this is the general vibe and feeling of the restaurant I'm looking for, right? And then it could be something where a director like wrote the script for a place, and there is a specific place that they are looking at. Like, you know, you open a script and it says, you know, interior, Penn Junior Station.
Cheesecake, yeah.
Yeah, Grand right. Central. You know, it's like, okay.
Solved.
Problem solved. We know we have to get into Grand Central. But yeah, this is the thing that you're starting to do, though.
Well, wait a minute, though. Actually, that it's not automatically solved, right?
No.
Because there are.
I was going to say.
Go ahead.
That's true.
Just sometimes.
What are you doing in there?
Yeah. Well, or also sometimes it's like it says Grand Central and it's not.
That's true.
I mean, you must have locations doubling as other locations all the time. We can probably think of examples.
So here's
of
like
this.
A thing that happens all the time. And thank you all for correcting me, but like. A TV series is supposed to take place in New York.
Okay.
Cost analysis is done. What does it cost to make this in New York versus what it costs to make this in Toronto? Even considering that Toronto isn't New York, but we can make taxi cabs and we can make subway stop entrances and we can use computer effects to show Midtown in the background. Right. That is all an additional cost. But if that is cheaper than making the show in New York, the production company may gladly spend the money in Toronto, even because the money spent is good money because it's cheaper than doing all of those things in practical location.
Okay, so I was talking about this internship where I threw scripts in a dumpster.
Yeah.
Guy I worked for, his name was Nicholas Palaiologos. He was my uncle's partner. He was also had like a political background. I think he was in the Massachusetts House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. So his job after this was he headed up the Massachusetts Film Office, where he was tasked with bringing big productions to film in Massachusetts. The office wound up being shut down, I guess, because it was just too much of a headache to actually try and film things in Massachusetts, right? It was just too much of a mess. So one of the films that he had started the process on was The Departed, which I think came out in 2007, I want to say. So
something like that.
It's 2006, 2007, yeah. Around there. Most of the exteriors... the movie takes place in Boston. There's no denying that.
You know? 100%.
Characters have Boston accents. Yeah. They call each other Sully and stuff like that. It's Boston, right? Most of the exteriors are filmed in New York because filming in Boston actually proved to be too troublesome.
They shot a lot in Boston.
They did shoot a lot in Boston. But
they didn't entirely. They didn't entirely shoot in Boston.
What they wanted were films like entirely made in Boston.
Yeah,
and my understanding of this production is that at times Boston became too much trouble to deal with.
Yes.
And shockingly enough, New York City. Well, I mean, not comparing Boston to New York City is not shocking.
But, I've worked in both places.
Yeah.
And it's a factor, right?
Yeah,
it all goes into this, is what we're talking about, the soft prep, right?
Which
is two hands. One is like physically, where, how, and how much. And then also creatively is like what it is, what it looks like, how it feels,
mm-hmm.
right? And trying to get that thing. So like if you're trying to build the world of Gotham City, right?
Mm.
There's a certain criteria there that you're looking to fulfill that is a certain kind of architecture that serves the story of Gotham City. So you will go, if you want to do your due diligence, because you're making a film for $200 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
And your possibilities are actually very open and very endless as to where you can do something. I imagine a movie like that spent anywhere from like a month to 3 months at least running, not only looking through different American cities, and maybe even as a hodgepodge, saying we can shoot parts of it in Chicago, we can shoot parts of it in Pittsburgh, we can shoot parts of it in New York, shoot parts of it here and there and there.
It also depends entirely on the vision of the filmmaker.
Yes.
You think about, we could talk about the Nolan Batman trilogy forever, right?
Sure.
And the kind of care that goes into a lot of the like exterior long shots that you see from Chicago and Pittsburgh and New York, using Manhattan as Gotham City at some points, but very clearly there's like scenes where, you know, there's that flying bat thing in the third one.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, hey, that's the Smithfield Street Bridge right by my house. We drive by the Joseph Gordon-Levitt cement plant, by the way, on our way to get wings in Southside.
Yeah.
The plant where he runs back into the driver.
Oh, I haven't noticed this.
And there's where all the explosions are, where Joseph Gordon-Levitt's driving the car through and he flips over. Yeah, that's right in it's right on our way into Southside where we go to that
That makes sense.
Restaurant that we like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, right?
It's like, here's the thing, though. Tim Burton, right?
Yes.
It's like, no, all this stuff has to be built. Yeah. Anything that's even being shot outside is just like, okay, well, we have to be on a street, so we'll use a real... Or maybe not. It could be a soundstage. I don't even know.
Probably, or a backlot.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So you're looking at two very different philosophies that inform that soft prep.
Exactly.
So this is like the time to identify, right? What is the philosophy?
Right.
Will everything be built? Will it be things... Will...
Can't.
Does the aesthetic that is being strived for exist in the real world, or does it need to be fabricated on a set, or does it need to be is it so fantastic that it needs to be fabricated on a computer?
Mm-hmm.
You're figuring this all out. You're running the cost analysis of these things. And then
they make a decision.
And then you start making some decisions.
Right.
And into those decisions, oh man, I bet you there were so many times just on the Batman thing where you could probably see Christopher Nolan and his DP and a production designer and some producers and a location guy like standing on a bridge here in Pittsburgh all wearing like orange vests and being like, well, I like that the bridge is yellow.
Yeah.
But it'd be cool maybe, do you think it'd be better if it was like a light blue because that's the color palette of this character at this time? Like, oh no, yellow is supposed to be this. And you can see this like going on for like 3-4 weeks. You know what I mean? Where everyone's like, well, let's find out if we can paint the bridge at all.
What?
Before we make the decision about the color of the bridge. Because if we can't paint the bridge and then I decide that it has to be blue, then maybe we can go find another bridge that is blue. That's
paint different. A bridge?
Yeah, why not? Paint it, change the color.
Just labor and money.
It's just labor and money, right? And it's just like a decision that has to be made. Or is it like, okay, well, let's just say that they don't paint the bridge. Do you like this backdrop more than all of the other bridges that we've seen in Pittsburgh? And if so, should we consider seeing if the visual effects company can make the bridge yellow or blue and not yellow?
Can't you just change
it
in post? Fix it in post?
Right. How much does it cost to fix in post and how much does it cost to paint the bridge?
It's got to be cheaper to fix it in post.
Maybe. It might not be. If you're doing really dynamic shots with a Batmobile, right, or whatever.
Yeah.
Is barreling through this bridge and the camera is changing the way it moves in every way. That might become a really big deal.
Lots of pixels.
Yeah, you might be, somebody may be essentially hand painting over the frame each part of the truss of the bridge that is yellow.
And at the end, that guy goes, hey, I could have just painted the fucking bridge.
Yeah, basically, you're going to pay to digitally paint the bridge for someone to go through it frame by frame and digitally paint it, or you're going to pay for people to practically paint it. This is the time of analysis because the last thing that you want to do is like misspend the money.
Yeah.
Right.
So
So you really do, and especially philosophically, if you're coming at it and you're trying to do things that the director wants to do, that you're doing in like good faith. It's like at least I think, and this, I don't want to get on too much of a tangent, but if the director goes, can we paint this bridge?
Yeah.
I feel like you're obligated as a person that's part of that production is to find out the answer. If you can paint the bridge and how much it would cost to paint the bridge versus how much it would be to do it digitally, and would run that analysis and kind of give that information to the greater conversation of, is this the right place to shoot this scene?
Is that a pretty common thing where like the logistics of something, like the answer to this question is an obvious yes.
Oh yeah.
But is that something that can hold up entire productions where logistics clash with vision?
Mm-hmm. Big time.
Yeah.
Or just cost, right? It's like we wrote this script. We said it was valued at $30 million and we think it's going to cost we thought it was going to cost $35 million to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But now we got to make it for less than 30. If it's going to be profitable, we have to make it for 20 million. Yeah. Mm. You get those conflicts real quick. So that's a thing that's constantly debated in the soft prep period and into prep, into regular pre-production, into like organizing and making the movie and taking it from an idea to taking it to physical reality is, you don't really know until you're kind of in it. And someone's really getting the estimate that day for how much it costs to build the Batcave, right? Because it's like, you don't know how much it's going to really cost to build the Batcave until you've decided which city you're in, where your mill is going to be that you're going to build this thing, where the stage is going to be that you're going to shoot the Batcave. And then, so you need to have all of those decisions in place before you hire the personnel to build it. You need to make sure that personnel is available. And if you don't reach a certain decision at a certain point, like we were talking about in the first half, I think, because like at some, or was it this half, you know, you might have to go off and take another job.
Right.
So if those people in Pittsburgh, let's just say that we're lined up to be Dark Knight construction guys, we're ready to work on it, build the Batcave in September, but then the movie pushes 2 months and they don't have to build the Batcave until November.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't wait around that long because they have lives to live, so they take another movie. Now the cost of building that Batcave is going to be a whole lot more because you've got to bring in carpenters from New York or Ohio or somewhere out of state because all the people here are already working.
Right.
So you don't know what that stuff costs until... So you may have a really good idea that the Batcave is going to cost $2 million to build, but in the time between theorizing what it's going to cost to build and actually materializing it and getting the materials, maybe it costs $2.1 million. And then you have to turn around, you know, or maybe it costs 2.5.
Right.
You have to turn around to a director and to the whole kind of creative team, as well as the logistics team. And you're like, shit, how do we make the same Batcave for less than $500,000 less?
I would think that because of the number of moving parts you have in something like this, mm-hmm. there would be padding.
Yeah.
If you had 20 million cap, right?
Yep.
It's like, okay,
contingency.
Figure out how to do everything for 17, and then we have padding.
Contingency, yeah.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Okay.
But even within that, right, is like, here's a more common than not problem on almost every movie I've ever been involved in. We don't have enough money.
Okay.
You know? It's just like,
I can imagine.
Pretty
yeah.
much, it doesn't matter what size.
It doesn't matter what size. We worked on like $200 million movies where we didn't have enough time or enough money for certain things. And like, things had to be parsed through really, really, really precisely. And the creative vision kind of poked and prodded at
mm-hmm.
a little bit.
Tell me a little bit more. Poked and prodded, creative vision poked and prodded.
Let's just say there's a shot that you want to do,
mm-hmm.
Like on the big scale action movies are always the easiest to pick on because they ask to do the most absurd things. And I think that's the thing that translates the best to people outside
yeah,
of the context
sure.
of things. You want to do a chase scene across the George Washington Bridge and the Batmobile is going to flip over on the bridge.
Yeah.
Right? You go to the state of New York and you spend like 3 months going, how can we make this work?
Yeah.
How can we make this shot in this movie that's going to be this iconic big thing? How can we make it work on the George Washington Bridge?
Now, is there like a commissioner of bridge stunts or who are you talking to?
There's the New York City Film Commission.
Okay, yeah.
There's
yep.
the mayor, which is part of the mayor's office, right?
So I was in Boston. Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there's like, for, oh man, that movie in Boston about the Boston bombing with Mark Wahlberg.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you can imagine the kind of asks that they were making.
Right.
To set an explosive off downtown, right? These yeah. are all, like so meaning it's a big, long, arduous process that's yeah. going to go in there. With many, many pushing factors. Traffic on the city, right? The impact and who's going to work on the bridge that day. How that's going to fuck up everybody at the MTA's work schedule because there's, like, an additional day where everyone's working where they shouldn't be and blah, blah, blah. That may come back to the studio where it's just far too expensive to shoot on the George Washington Bridge, and it's far too big of a scale of a thing to build the George Washington Bridge on one floor with a green screen. And so you might ultimately have to go back and say, okay, is there another bridge that this can be shot on?
Mm.
And you'll probably run that exercise. And if the answer there is no.
Well, what would the answer there be no? Like, is that
traffic impact is
money.
Too high on
okay.
the city.
All right. So that could be a creative no, or it could be a logistic no. It could come from yeah. either direction. All right.
Often yeah. a financial no.
Okay.
No. Right, this will right. happen sometimes too, where like you find this awesome house that you want to shoot in and you go in there and you offer a contract to the people to film in their home. And then you do like a technical scout. And all this whole huge crew comes into your home
mm-hmm. tech scout,
to check it out, like 60 people. And you're like, oh, my God, this is terrifying.
Yeah, it's like the end of
and
E.T.
And everyone's rude in here.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't want these people shooting and filming in my house for 3 weeks. Sorry, no. No amount of money will change my mind.
Sure.
Boom. Here's a curveball. Here's a huge curveball that came your way. If that was like the aesthetically perfect house that conveyed everything that you wanted to convey, it was perfect for your storytelling, perfect for your logistics, you got all the permits you needed and yada, yada, yada.
I'm surprised anybody
you
would do that.
For a lesser house.
I mean, wouldn't you have to remove walls and lay tracks down and all the, well, I mean, I guess it depends on what kind
quote,
of a shoot. Yeah.
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
I would rather have the army set up camp in my front yard for 3 months than have a film company turn around in my driveway. So true. So true.
Yeah.
It really is.
Well, often
it's a destructive process.
If you're shooting in a house or something like that, like the company will pay to have those people like put up in a hotel for like X amount of days. So they're not there to witness what happens.
Right.
Most of the time.
Mm. Yeah.
But still, I mean, there's no reconciling the fact that once everybody leaves and you come back into your house and you're like, you know, there's a chunk of your floor has just been ripped out.
No, the scene in the money pit where the construction crew shows up, that also comes to mind, right? And as Tom Hanks is driving away, the last thing he sees is like the side of the something ripping all the siding off the house.
That's kind of it.
You
know?
Yeah.
It's never anything good. You know, you want to like, you're going to at least be screwing holes into people's ceilings. And you're also, you know, you're putting
I could imagine
it'd
be a very difficult process.
The big
one
is everyone's lawns get destroyed.
Oh, of course.
If it rains.
The rains, and then you got machines working, big machines. Yeah, destroyed. Mm-hmm. So this is the process of the pre-production, right? You're figuring out the schedule. You're figuring out actors' availability as they fit into the schedule becomes a logistic consideration for the locations that you're scouting and what you're putting those locations together with and how they're going, right? So like Bane's availability, Batman's availability, what's Michael Caine's character's name?
Alfred.
Sorry, guys. It's been a minute. Alfred's availability is like you juggle all of those things. Those are the building blocks. That's going to kind of inform part of your decisions of where you're going to film, what you're going to change. And all of these things, all of these different factors from tax incentives to actor availability to the bridge you want to throw a car off of to the building you want to explode and how you need to keep that building safe versus how you have to keep another building safe and the cost and that. There's just a million and a half decisions that basically need to get made. And that is the process of pre-production is putting forth the vision and then figuring out how to physically materialize that vision. And kind of re-guiding and reconnoitering things as it goes along, as you learn the information of your limitations financially, the limitations of the environments you want to shoot in, and the limitations of a million other things that you pile on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's do each of your last days on a production.
Last days.
Right. You're Dutch as a first AD, you're there before you would be there, right, Scott?
Yes. No.
No?
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
I'm there first.
Before. Yeah, you are there before I am. I thought you were talking about day to day, who gets there first.
Oh, that's no contest. That's Scott.
Right. Well, right. So do you leave at the same time?
Nope.
Or, okay, are you?
Wait.
All right. We should do the day to day.
In prep?
Let's do a day. Let's do a shoot day.
Okay. Yeah. Well. I'm talking about the whole production, right?
Whole production.
I'm guessing you're departing at pretty close to the same time. Maybe you're there a little longer.
Oh, at the end of the film.
Like, yeah.
No. We're done. We're done the same day.
Same day.
Okay. Yeah. And your last day is when the
last day of shooting.
Last day we're done shooting.
Okay.
Yeah, unless you're going to another job early, which rarely happens, or something like that. But it's like last.
Or you know, you're going to take 3 months off of production to come back in the winter to shoot a winter unit or something like that. You're done for. Yeah.
All right. Let's go through a day of production.
Let's do it.
All right.
I'm about to do that.
And I guess we could, I don't know, you guys can decide if something you worked on together in these roles that we've discussed, first AD and second AD.
A specific day might be too much context to give to that would take us away from.
Typical day? How do you want to do it?
Yeah, typical day. I think what's kind of maybe valuable for anyone in your audience who wants to make a picture. Or is just curious about what the hell it is.
I wanted this show to change the way people watch movies to some degree.
Oh, we're going to have to do more than one of these to get to that, though.
Well, we will.
Because that's the quickest way to change the way people watch movies is to introduce, in my opinion, is to introduce the sort of visual grammar and vocabulary to people. And it gives them the tools to actually, like, it's one of these interesting things about learning about film.
Yeah.
You have to give people, and you can tell me, because you studied film, right?
Yeah.
Full disclosure, college dropout, terrible high school student, didn't study film in any formal way.
Yeah.
I'm the opposite.
Yeah. I worked in DVD stores, watched a million movies.
I did that too.
By director. I read every book I could get my hands on. I skipped every class I ever had in college to spend time in the library reading about how to make films. and on the internet teaching myself how to do green screen and how to work cameras and learning and absorbing everything I could in a completely self-motivated way.
Mm-hmm.
But I did take two film classes when I was in college just as electives and just because I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
So what, average day?
Yeah. So average day.
One of the other things too, side goal. I've field tested this with a lot of women, watching movies, like with girlfriends and stuff through my life. And I'll pause and I'll say, do you see what's happening here? See
what they're doing here? Oh no.
Yeah.
Do you see what's happening here?
Do you see what's happening? This has never gone over well. I need to find the person who's like, yes, please. They turn away from the TV to me and they say, what's happening here?
Yeah.
Tell me. But that woman doesn't appear to exist from my experience.
Good luck
with that. The reason I went down that track is because you can tell me if I'm wrong or right here. But I think personally, you need to give people, for them to like understanding movies, you don't really need to give them all that much. It's like one of these things where if you introduce the concept well enough to understand like causal relationships and juxtaposition and relativity within like a frame, like things being bigger than other things as a way of highlighting importance, or things being closer to the center of the frame to indicate things that are of higher importance, like these kinds of like basic, really basic principles, you build a language of a film around.
Mm-hmm.
Is like once you introduce these basic concepts to people, they learn so much on their own just by continuing to watch different films.
Sure.
So it's a really kind of, to me, is a really interesting and special thing, is you hand somebody like a very small key that opens one door, but in doing so, you're giving them many keys to open many doors on their own, because it's something that builds off of itself. Like you can teach yourself film and film appreciation with a very small little push off, basically.
I agree. And I think when you see something being done and you understand why it was being done, or maybe the intention behind something being done.
Like what a shot means.
What a shot means.
Yeah, what it means.
Or what it does, you know. And I mean, I always go back to like my pantheon of favorite filmmakers and the things that they do. But that, so much appreciation comes from that, because I mean, this is something that should fascinate people because of the scale. To go from like this process of coordination that we've been talking about to this thing that ultimately asks for maybe an hour and 40 minutes of your time in the end. It's an amazing kind of funnel down to that.
Yeah.
You know,
I think so.
And it's this really impressive collision of science and art, you know, filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the arts too. It's like music,
sculpture,
fine arts. Exactly. Sculpture,
design. Theater. Yeah, exactly.
That's a good combination.
But I think it's really, to me, has always been crazy interesting, and something that I want to, in my personal life, get more into, which is educating people about these things, because I feel like schooling, in a certain sense, has equipped you to do this with literature, and hasn't equipped you to do this at all with any visual medium.
Okay.
And everyone consumes a ton of the visual medium from when they are a child. And it's like something that hasn't quite caught up, where like you think about it and like what's of tremendous use to you. Learning how to read and write is of tremendous use to you in your life and like your ability to learn and your ability to grow. And maybe you don't need to know how to write films or TV shows or videos, but I think it is, if you've never been taught how to read them, you are actually A, missing out on things, and B, in a certain way, you're more susceptible to like the thing that we opened the show about, is like manipulations and not being aware of them, and also misinterpreting them drastically.
What I call symbolic programming.
Yes.
Right. Not being able to read what's in a frame or why something's in a frame to understand. And sometimes it's really simple, right? Like a YouTube channel has a political agenda and, you know, they're talking to you through like pop-up pictures in the background.
Yep.
What are the pictures they're choosing and how much of this story, what weight of the content is on the visual portion of it,
right,
you know, versus the spoken portion of it. And people, you know, they miss these things in advertising. They miss these things in television. If you are illiterate in that sense, you can be programmed.
Yeah.
And there's people counting on that kind of programming.
Yeah.
What is it? What's
No, I like that. That's great.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think that, I don't know, I think it's a really important thing to expose yourself to and learn for all of those reasons, but also the fact that, like, I don't know, storytelling is so critically important to our, to any part of a culture and
to teaching.
Teaching. Yeah. It really is a teaching. So it's like, on top of all of that, it's like, yeah, you want to be able to even derive more meaning from things that you think are inspiring or shape you or teach you something is to, like, if you can't read the language of film, right, you're only like deriving a certain percentage of the meaning or the knowledge that could be passed down.
Yeah. And scaling that or extending that across any visual medium is really important, because these are things that affect people emotionally. And this is, again, not to be conspiratorial, but this is something that programmers count on. Right? A person will be affected emotionally by something. Now, it could be completely innocuous, as in a movie, like you're supposed to take a certain emotion away from a visual presentation of something.
Yep.
Or it could be more malevolent in its intent, right? If it's politically slanted, a visual is produced that we do happen to see. And I'm not, you know, focusing in on one side of the political spectrum here. I think this applies to both sides. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people running around in the world today who have very strong feelings about things and aren't sure why.
Right.
And I attribute a lot of that to things that impact people's emotions in ways that they often don't understand or don't even recognize. They don't even see it, and it happens through repetition.
Yep.
A great deal of it is visual.
Yeah.
I pay a lot of attention to children's programming, which in many cases is completely demented and terrifying. But I think that kind of, I know I'm repeating myself now, but that kind of literacy is very important. And this is a really, really interesting way to start engaging with it through film.
Yes.
Crashing cars never seem to collide. Sometimes when I'm staring out my window, catch the stars and watch as they go by. I've been sending signals into outer space. Spiral light, finger in the sky. And it blows my mind. Every day I'm drawn to my window.